It's time now for Panty versus Homophobia. She is no stranger to this city, so please give a great Amnesty International Belfast Pride welcome to tonight's speaker, Panty Bliss.
Hi. Hi. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Hi. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. That's very lovely. It's because I look fucking amazing, isn't it? I usually get that sort of reaction. I feel bad for Peter Tatchell in his jacket and trousers. Yes, that's a glass of wine. I hope you don't mind. It's, you know, Friday night. You're at a drag show. I'm working. So really, who's the loser here? I just want to start off by saying that I'm often introduced nowadays as an activist, and I'm always a little uncomfortable about that because I don't feel that I deserve the respect that that word suggests. You know, for example, the people who work for Amnesty, who chose and decided to make it their life's work, to activate on behalf of other people. I am, I always say, an accidental activist. And by that, I mean is that I didn't choose activism, it sort of chose me, in that the problem for me is that I have a big mouth. And I know it's hard to ignore a drag queen anyway, but you know, I've been a performer for 25 years, and that has given me a sort of profile or a platform that, you know, amplifies my voice. And that's a lucky thing to have, but it does mean that then sometimes I will say something and other people will take great exception to what I said, and then they will sort of come at me in some way, sometimes legally, sometimes with a bottle of wine, and then I find myself in a position where I have to defend myself, and in order to do that, I have to be an activist. So my motivations have always been entirely selfish, and so I'm always a little uncomfortable when people call me an activist. I will say that a lot of the reason that I'm here this evening is because I got myself into trouble by opening my big mouth back in December, and it's been a sort of an unusual and weird journey. And I'd first like to sort of sketch out what exactly happened, because I don't know how familiar you all are with that, because I think it's instructive to the subject we're here to talk about tonight. So back in December, I was approached by a chat show, an RTE chat show, and they asked me if I would appear on the show and perform. And I said yes, because I thought they meant the Late Late Show, but they didn't. You know, the idea was that I would do a performance. That's what the thing was. And then that afterwards, there'd be a small interview. And, you know, so I had a few meetings with the producers coming up to it. And all of the focus was on what my performance would be. And the interview was very much sort of an afterthought. And even on the night of this show, you know, just before we went on, they showed me the cue cards of the presenter. His name is Brendan O'Connor. And, you know, I saw the questions. And they were all the usual stuff that I get asked all of the time. You know, how did I first get into drag? How long does it take me to get ready? Shouldn't you have that rash looked at? And you know, and clearly I was meant to be the light bit of fluff in the show. You know, they all had a very serious segment about this guy who's dying of cancer. So I was supposed to be the sort of light relief. And so we went on and we did the interview and I thought it all went beautifully. you know, he asked me some questions, and I answered them, and the audience, who were mostly made up of straight couples who'd been minibused in from Mullingar, they all laughed about it, and it all seemed fine. Now, it is true that along the way, a casual discussion about the nature of homophobia arose. And it is true that during that casual discussion, I did say that I felt that people who actively campaign for gay people to be treated differently or less than anyone else may be construed, possibly, as homophobic. And it is true that also I did name two well-known journalists who had written many things about gay people, and I did name those as the kind of people who are sometimes mean and horrible, which, by the way, is not actionable, that's just an opinion, mean and horrible about the gays. And it is also true that then, at the urging of the host, he, you know, asked me to name some names. And of course, I momentarily thought, really, Queen? But then I thought, oh, what the hey, what's the worst that could happen? So I named those two journalists, and I also named a, you know, certainly down in Dublin, a relatively well-known, very tiny, very fringe, ultra-Catholic, right-wing organization with campaigns against gay marriage. I named them as well. But everything else seemed fine. And afterwards, clearly, so did everybody else involved in that TV show, because it was all, you know, claps on the back and air kissing and let us call you a taxi. And if I had bumped into any of you over the next few days and you had said, oh, how did that TV thing go? I would have said, oh, that, yeah, it all went fine. And then the solicitor's letters started arriving. Now, over the next few days, I got 5 solicitor's letters claiming that I had defamed 5 upstanding, non-homophobic, gay-loving, three-bean-salad-eating, Brokeback Mountain-watching, Liza-listening, apple-martini-drinking, upstanding members of the heterosexual community. Now, the letters all claimed that I had defamed these people, and the letters came from the 2 journalists that I had named as mean and horrible, and then 3 members of this, you know, group, the Iona Institute. Now, I'm going to put that in inverted commas because it's actually instructive, because here in Northern Ireland, you can't just call any group an institute. You have to actually be an institute. There are rules and regulations. But I'm afraid down in Dublin, you can call any old group you want an institute. And they ain't an institute. Nobody's learning anything there except maybe how to dress badly or... You know, anytime lesbians kiss, an angel dies of the sad. So 3 other members of this institute were also suing me for defamation, and I hadn't even mentioned them. I'd never even heard of them before. One of them kept insisting that his name was Doctor. But of course, it turns out that that's just like institute, you know, because he ain't a real doctor. He's a doctor of theology, which is like being a doctor of Harry Potter studies. Anyway, now the letters all claimed that I had defamed these 5 people by possibly suggesting, depending on how you interpreted the words that I said in the order that I said them, that maybe it might be possible to infer, if you were a small child passing on a bicycle, that these people could be considered homophobic. And the letters all demanded that I offer a fulsome public apology or they would see me in court. Now, obviously, I wasn't going to apologize because A, I'm very stubborn. I've always been very stubborn. And B, I meant it. And C, the gays would have killed me. Anyway, the next thing I know, RTÉ take down the interview from the internet. And suddenly, I'm the kind of person that needs a legal team. And thankfully, every gay lawyer in the country volunteers to represent me. And it turns out that that is a lot of lawyers. Turns out you can't swing a solicitor gay down the law library without taking out a bunch of barrister dykes. And for the next few weeks, this now was not a mainstream media story, because the mainstream media were absolutely terrified of these defamation suits that were flying around. And of course, RTÉ had gotten those. They were also being sued, RTÉ. So it wasn't really a mainstream story. But online, you know, the gays are constantly tapping away when they're not on Grindr. And so it was it was bubbling up, and it refused to sort of go away. And then after a couple of weeks, RTÉ apologized on air. And that really annoyed me, of course. But it also annoyed a lot of other people. And then it turned out that RTÉ paid over €85,000 to these people to make these, you know, defamation suits go away. And that really annoyed people. And so suddenly all hell broke loose. And for the next couple of weeks, I couldn't turn on the radio or the TV, but, you know, people were talking about me, you know, denouncing me or defending me. You know, there were protests and megaphones in the city center stopping traffic. And my mother was on the phone all upset and afraid to open a newspaper. And I, you know, myself and my lawyer were spending more time together than the Fritzl family. And then... Anyway, it was all sort of, it was sort of a difficult and distressing sort of time, to be honest. You know, just weird and uncomfortable, as I imagine maybe sex with Michael Flatley might be. And but then I was invited to make a speech at the Abbey Theatre. Now, when the Abbey asked me to speak, I think they were doing that, you know, for a bit of mischief, to be honest. And, of course, I was very topical at the time. And I think the Abbey likes its sort of history of agitation, you know, riots outside the theatre and all that sort of stuff. And I agreed to do it because I know the people in the Abbey well. I've done my show there and all, so I would have said yes anyway. But the real reason I agreed to do it was, up until that point, the whole thing had become this sort of political football, and everyone was afraid to talk directly to me in case I went running off defaming people. And the whole thing had become this sort of really sort of teenage argument. So I wanted to have an opportunity to speak on my own behalf without the filter of a producer or a lawyer or anybody else and say just what I had to say about it. And so I agreed to do it, and that's what I did. Now, I didn't think overly hard about it. I just let it percolate for a few days, and then on the afternoon of giving the speech, I sort of wrote something down, and then I ran through it once or twice in my living room in front of my dog, Penny, and she seemed decidedly unimpressed. And then that evening, I got a cab over to the Abbey, and I gave the speech. Now, I assumed that the only people that would ever hear this speech were the 500 people that were there in the auditorium. But that was enough for me, because I was doing this for me. At that point, it had all become this silly debate about the definition of homophobia. It turns out that people are very concerned what the dictionary definition of homophobia is. And I just wanted to remind people what I felt this was actually about. And so that's what I did. I said what I had to say. It seemed to go well. I left the theater. People said some nice things on my way out. And then I jumped in a cab and went to do my regular stupid bar show. But then 24 hours later, I was spreading faster than legs at a One Direction concert. And the speech went around the world. It was translated into 15 different languages. It was, tweeted and retweeted and blogged and Tumblr'd. It was broadcast on radio and television in France and Italy and Canada. I was interviewed by the BBC and Channel 4 and CNN and Reuters. It was brought up, in our own Dáil. It was raised in the European Parliament. It was all just absolutely nuts. And then one sort of bizarre afternoon, I find myself in the newsroom of RTE, surrounded by all of those news reporters that I'm so familiar with. And we're all standing there watching a parliamentary debate about Pantygate on the fucking TV screen. It was sort of this whole weird thing. And then suddenly people start stopping me in the street to shake my hand and say, fair play to you. And, owl fellas in soccer jerseys are stopping me to tell me about their lesbian daughter. And then suddenly all the emails and the letters and the cards and the flowers start arriving. And they just keep on arriving. And they are coming from everywhere. They're coming from Dublin and Belfast and Limerick and Frankfurt and Adelaide and Chicago. And they are from 12-year-old girls and 50-year-old taxi drivers. And they're from lesbians in Denmark and straight guys in Scotland. And they're not just from gay people. All of these people are telling me their stories. And their stories, they feel they are relating in some way to what I said in a way that I could never have possibly imagined. And it isn't just gay and lesbian people. It's, fat kids in school and people in wheelchairs and people with Asperger's. And there was even this ginger guy in London who wrote me this letter. He was fed up having to check himself for being ginger. I even got one card that had a 50-euro note inside it and a scrawl note that just said, for the wig fund. And suddenly this thing that had started out so, annoyingly and distressing, was suddenly this whole other thing. And I was sort of standing in the middle of this whirlwind thinking, how the feck did that happen? And the point is that all of that happened because I had dared to use the word homophobia. And it turns out that that word is very controversial. Nobody now wants to be identified as a homophobe. And in a way, you could argue that that's progress. We now live in a society that nobody wants to be accused of any kind of bigotry. I mean, even this morning I was on the Nolan show with some evangelical Christian who was accusing me of being the bigot. So absolutely nobody wants to be accused of being a homophobe. Now, the reason for that is that most people see themselves as good people. Most people think, I'm one of the good guys. And those people who then articulate a view that's based in homophobia, they don't want to admit where that is coming from. And I don't want to pick on religious people, I'm not going to, but I will say that religious people have this thing where, because I'm religious, so I must be good. And they want to separate the sin from the sinner. They want to say to you, oh, but I love you, the sinner, but I hate the sin. And that may work for thievery, but it doesn't work when the sin is an intrinsic, essential part of who you are. You cannot separate the sin from the sinner when it comes to sexuality. But people will try to. There's another, people also, it's about that the word homophobia. So people will run to dictionaries. People, it turns out, put in an awful lot of assurance in a dictionary, as if a dictionary is going to tell them what's right and what's wrong. And of course, words evolve. They have the meaning that we give them. People who write dictionaries don't just make it up off their own heads. They take their lead from us. And all of those people who are terrified to be called a homophobe, they want to single out the word phobia and say, I'm not afraid of you. I'm not afraid. I don't have an irrational fear. And I will agree with that. I don't think that Edwin Poots passes by a hairdresser and shudders. Well, he might. So I will give them that. They're not driven by some sort of an irrational fear. But homophobia, it means that it isn't just, reduced down to a sort of irrational fear. It's also a dislike or a discomfort with homosexuality. And I would suggest that all of the people who campaign against equal rights for gay people are driven by a discomfort with homosexuality. Because the problem is that homophobia is actually all pervasive in our society. It drips through our society. It pervades every part of it. Now, the people who will argue against equal rights for gay people will sort of say to me, oh, that's ridiculous. They say to me all the time, look at, a gay person in Uganda. They try to separate out degrees of homophobia and say it's not homophobia unless you're being lynched, unless you're being thrown in jail. And of course, am I going to suggest for a moment that we are in the same situation as a gay kid in Uganda or in Russia? Of course I'm not going to say that. But that does not mean that we, in countries where we have the basic rights as gay people, that does not mean that we have to accept or put up with the low level of homophobia that pervades our society. We have gotten so used to checking ourselves. We've gotten so used to sort of acting in a particular way to sort of not give off your homosexuality. We have gotten so used to that low level of homophobia that tries to sort of corral you in a particular way that we think it's normal. We've accepted it. And the point is that we don't have to accept it, and we shouldn't accept it. I'm talking about that low level of homophobia, the kind of things that when your sister is doing the wedding plan for her wedding, and your Aunt Marjorie says, oh, don't put Aunt June on the table with the gays. Or worse, she'll say, oh, don't put, Jacinta on the table. She's only 17. As if somehow a 17-year-old isn't safe at a table with gays at a wedding. Or the primary school teacher who hasn't even really considered it, but somehow finds themselves sort of allowing people to assume heterosexuality about them because they just don't want to have that awkward thing where the parents know there's a gay teaching the class. I mean, that sort of stuff is insidious. That's the stuff that eats away at you, those small sort of psychic cuts that gay people every day sort of learn to put up with. That thing when you get on the train to Dublin or wherever and you go into the carriage and there's like a bunch of lads there and they're drinking cans of beer, and you think for a moment, am I looking too dykey? Am I looking too gay? Maybe I'll just sit in another carriage. You shouldn't have to consider yourself in that way. You have every right to sit in that carriage. They're the problem. But we have internalized that sort of homophobia that we find ourselves being the one constantly checking ourselves. The gays do it. We've all taken that on ourselves. We all huddle in sort of major cities in and around the gay areas. We don't hold hands with your boyfriend in certain parts of the city. I mean, when I look at straight people, I'm not jealous. I think I'm just as fabulous, more fabulous. I don't want to be straight. You know, there was a time in my life when I found it difficult, you know, to accept that I was gay. But once I had, my God, I'm so relieved. You know, I look at the pressures that my brother has as a straight guy, to find a nice wife and settle down and all of that stuff. And I don't want that. Part of the wonderful and amazing thing about being gay for me was that it sort of liberated me in some ways from the expectations of society. Hey, I'm gay. And then people stopped asking me about the match last night. Do you know what I mean? I found that utterly liberating to be that. But us gays, we have taken that on. And we sort of, in some ways, have started to separate ourselves into acceptable LGBTI and unacceptable. I mean, it's probably most virulent, I have to say, amongst gay men who are really hung up on gender. But it's also true in the dykes. The femme dykes are somehow more acceptable than the butch dykes, aren't they? I mean, that's how we think about it. And, of course, amongst the gay men, it's absolutely rancid that, of course, like everybody nowadays, the gays are all finding each other online, and every second profile says mask for mask. They're desperate that, you know, a feminine guy wouldn't say hello to them. You know, that prospect terrifies them, you know, as they pose for their perfectly lit selfie in their bathroom mirror, and in the back you can see the reflection of their Barbra Streisand commemorative poster framed. Mask for mask. You know, Halloween is over, chicken. You can lose the mask. That sort of sense of gender discombobulation, as I like to say it, is at the root of so much homophobia. Because people equate, you know, certainly male homosexuality with femininity. And that is really at the root of so much of the homophobia in our culture. We are very uncomfortable with people who don't fit easily into the gender boxes they were assigned at birth. We grow up in a society that, you know, picks on femmy boys and butch girls. It's just part and parcel of the sort of world we live in, and that has, you know, seeped into our own views of ourselves. I mean, if I had a pound for every time, you know, one of my opponents trying to dismiss me as that bloke in a dress, you know, well, I'd be living next door to Rory McIlroy. The other thing, of course, that drives homophobia, and it's an uncomfortable one, is it's about the sex act. Homophobes don't like the gay sex act. That's what drives a lot of it. Now, where they pick that up, well, there's lots of reasons where they pick that up. But in essence, they're against buggery. And it doesn't matter if you're a lesbian, they think you bugger each other too. That is what drives so much homophobia. And you may be asking, why is she bringing that up? Well, I'll tell you why I'm bringing that up. Because the people who are against the LGBTI community, those people reduce you to that single sex act. To them, you're not actually people. You are not people who have brothers and cousins and teachers and lovers. You're not people who go to work in the morning and get tired and come home. You're not people who argues with your lover and leaves and you're really annoyed and comes home later and, you know, says they're sorry. None of that stuff applies to you because you're not a real person. You're a sex act. And that manifests itself in so many ways. Earlier this year, for example, I was invited to go to New York to participate in a parade called the St. Pat's for All Parade in Queens, aptly. And now, that's been 15 years, and the reason there is one at all is because gay people are not allowed to march in the New York St. Patrick's Parade. And the New York St. Patrick's Parade is run by this group called the Ancient Order of Hibernians. They're sort of a Catholic group. They're sort of like a Catholic version of the Orange Order. And they even dress similarly. And they won't allow gay people to march in the parade. Now, if you are a volleyball team and Irish, you can march in that parade. If you're a fireman and Irish, you can march in that parade. If you are an Indian group who also has some sort of Irish connection, you can march in that parade. Anybody can march in that parade, you know, if they have any sort of Irish connection. But the only group they won't allow are gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender and intersex people are not allowed march in that parade. And the reason is because they don't see you as people marching in the parade. They see you as bringing sex to the parade. You're a sex act walking in the parade. Now, the leader of the Ancient Order of Hibernians is this sort of 80-year-old man and his lovely wife, and they seem like a nice, regular couple. And he looks at us and sees a sex act, and so won't allow us in the parade. But I don't look at him and just see a sex act. I look at him and his lovely wife, and I see them as a whole person, as whole people, and they see themselves. If you ask him about his relationship with his wife, he'll tell you, oh, we've been together for 60 years. I remember when our first child was born. I remember when, you know, she miscarried our third child. I remember when she was sick and I, you know, nursed her through it. I remember when we saw our oldest child, you know, graduate from university, and what a proud moment that was. I remember the day I retired and when they gave me the gold watch and she was so thrilled for me. You know, he sees himself as somebody who has a whole relationship with the whole person, but he can't give us that same respect. He won't give us that same respect, and therefore he reduces us to a sex act, and he won't allow sex acts walk in his parade. And that is homophobia, because we are more than a sex act. He refuses to give us our humanity. He literally takes away our humanity and reduces us to an act that half of these queens have never even done. They've tried. But then you have to ask yourself, well, so homophobia is everywhere. We're all in some way affected by it. We all have some degree of homophobia, and that's the truth. And that is why it isn't the worst thing in the world to call somebody a homophobe. I mean, when those people sued me for suggesting that they might be in that way inclined, you know, to me, the weirdest thing about it was that they were so upset at all. Don't, you know, if you're going to actively campaign for gay people to be treated differently than anybody else, well, then own it. Don't actively campaign for gay people to be treated differently than everybody else and then get upset when somebody suggests that that might be considered homophobic. You know, just the idea that they were so upset in the first place is so weird. And anyway, of course, if you don't want people to suggest that you might be homophobic, well, there's one easy way to do that, and that is to stop actively campaigning for gay people to be treated differently than anybody else. And anyway, homophobe is not the worst thing you can call somebody. Solange Knowles is. But if everybody is in some way and in some degree homophobic, well, then you have to ask yourself, well, what do we do about that? Or, you know, what's the issue? Well, I will divide homophobes into two groups. There are those people who have a private discomfort with homosexuality, basically because they've never been exposed to enough gay people. So if you are, you know, Susan, you're living in Banbridge, and you're 65 years old, you don't have any gay friends, you don't really have any. As far as you were concerned, the only gay you've ever heard of was, you know, Mr. Inman from the Are You Being Served? You know, she was deeply shocked when Liberace came out. And then Susan is sitting there on her television one night, and she turns it on, and she sees, you know, Grainne and Shannon, they're getting civilly partnered in Belfast, the very first couple ever to get civilly partnered in the UK. And Susan sees that, and she thinks, oh, well, they seem very happy, but, you know, I'm just not so sure about that. That's not marriage to me. That's not what I think of as marriage. I'm uncomfortable with that. And maybe Susan's neighbour, Marjorie, is much more harsh about it. Maybe she thinks that's disgusting and that's absolutely not a marriage. That's a sham. Well, you know, to be honest, I have little or no problem with Susan and Marjorie. I would hope that one day they would meet gay people, realize that they are full-rounded human beings, that they're just the same as her, that they do all of the same thing, that they have to wee in the morning and they go to Tesco's. You know, I would hope that she would do that and she would find that gay people are nice ones and there are mean ones and, you know, that they're just regular people and that she would understand that they have regular relationships and that those relationships would be cherished equally along with every other kind of, you know, heterosexual relationships. And I would hope that she would come to that point in her life for her own sake as much as for mine, you know, because, you know, Susan not really liking me from a distance doesn't bother me, but I think Susan would be much happier if she had a gay to help her with the decorating or whatever. So, but so I can live with that. Susan can live her life with her private, you know, homophobia, and I'm fine with that. But it is entirely different to then turn that private discomfort with homosexuality into a public manifestation, in a sense. It is entirely different than to publicly campaign to have gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersex people treated differently and less than everybody else. That's entirely different, and that is the kind of homophobia that I think it's our duty to call out when we see it. It's our duty to stand up against it. Now, one of the things that I'm always getting thrown at me, and I got it thrown at me this morning on the Nolan show by this evangelical guy, was that really I'm the bigot, that I'm trying to close down the debate, that I don't want to give him the right to express his opinion. And of course, that's absolutely bullshit. I have never argued that these people are not entitled to have their views, no matter how silly they are. And I have never argued that they shouldn't be able to do that and they shouldn't be able to have those feelings. I have no problem with anyone's private feelings about me. Other people's, you know, opinion of me is none of my business, as RuPaul once said. So I'm okay with that. But they will suggest that by me asking them to stop arguing or, you know, refuting their arguments for equality for gay people, they're like, that I'm trying to shut them down, that I'm the bigot, that I have a bigoted view of religious people. What? I'm not the one arguing for a certain subsection of the population to be denied the same rights and privileges that everybody else has. LGBTI people are supposedly equal citizens of this country. They pay the same taxes. They pay the same television license. They have all of the same responsibilities of citizenship, but not all of the privileges. And that is homophobic. There's no other word left to describe that. If we're not allowed to use the word homophobic, if calling somebody a homophobe is somehow to be interpreted as me being a bigot trying to shut down the debate, well, we might as well just stop speaking English and start, you know, a whole new language. Problem is that there are no rational arguments against allowing LGBTI people get married. None of the arguments are rational. Now, I'm assuming that I'm speaking to the converted here, so I'm not going to sort of bore you, but I'm going to just very briefly run through their favorite talking points. First of all, they say that it's a religious objection and that I am somehow bigoted against religious people and I'm trying to stop them, you know, living their religious life. Well, of course I'm not. They can go to any church they want to, any Sunday. I'm thrilled for them. there'll be more room at brunch. So their argument is that it's a religious conviction of theirs. And, well, I would say we don't live in a theocracy, thankfully. We do not live in a theocracy. So they are welcome to their religious conviction. I'm not asking for religious marriage to be extended to everybody. I know that some gay people would like that, but I think you're on a loser there. I think any group can have their own silly rules if they want to. We're asking for civil marriage. We are full and equal citizens of this country, and we deserve the same full and equal privileges and rights. Their other one is, of course, the definition of homophobia, which just drives me insane. That's not an argument. Sorry, the definition of marriage. The marriage is defined as a union between a man and a woman. That drives me mad. First of all, language is living and alive, and we can expand words all the time. We do expand words all the time. But secondly, of course, that's not an argument against same-sex marriage. That's an argument against dictionaries. So if you really have a problem with dictionaries, take it up with Oxford. Then, of course, children. You know, this is a red herring they always throw out. First of all, they try to make it seem, you know, that gay couples are wandering through, you know, orphanages like Tesco's picking babies off the shelf. Then, of course, there is this sort of, oh, when marriage is a child-centered institution and it is only there for, you know, the benefit of children, which, of course, is bullshit. that totally dismisses infertile couples. Are couples who simply choose not to have babies, are they also not actually married? And of course, the real issue here is, you know, it isn't actually about gay couples trying to adopt. Gay couples, whether, you know, people who object or not, they do have children. Gay couples are raising children now. You know, there are many lesbians that are out around the country driving kids to school right now. Well, not right now, but you know what I'm saying. LGBTI people are raising children. And so the question is, well, first of all, I would say the opponents of same-sex marriage never bothered to go and talk to these mythical children. They're always banging on about them, but they've never bothered to even pick up the phone and talk to one. And there are many, many, many children in this country being raised by gay couples, and many, many who have already flown the coop and are living their own lives and are perfectly able to express their own view on how it was. And, of course, the real question is, what is the best thing for those children? What is the very best thing for those children? And, of course, the best thing for those children is for their parents to be married, for their families to be treated exactly the same as everybody else, for their families to be given the same respect by the society that we live in as everybody else. You know, this society encourages and pushes us to get married from the day we are bleeding born. It's everything your parents want for you. The fairy tales you read all don't end happily unless somebody is walking up the aisle. You know, that is, every little girl wants to be, you know, a princess bride. And just because one day she turns out that she's a lesbian, it doesn't mean that she doesn't want to be a princess bride anymore. Why is it that the day you say, "Hi, Mom, I'm a lesbian," they go, "Oh, not for you, this is for your sister," you know? Then, of course, the one that was thrown at me this morning, too, you said they all have the same problem, is that it's undemocratic. They tried to persuade me this morning that in Northern Ireland, only, you know, 30% or something of people support gay marriage. Now, first of all, I would take issue with that. I think we have other polls to say differently. But even if that is true, let's imagine that only 20% of the population of Northern Ireland supports same-sex marriage. What has that got to do with anything? Thankfully, the rights of minorities are not decided on in a decent democracy by the majority. Rights aren't a gift from people who are bigger or stronger than you. They're an innate gift. They are yours already. So it doesn't matter what a poll tells me. And, you know, to follow that logic, it was the evangelical guy again who brought that up, to follow that logic, he must be thrilled about the treatment of Christians in Mosul. He must be thrilled about the treatment of, you know, Christians in Saudi Arabia. Because in Saudi Arabia, the majority of people don't want to give Christians the same rights as everybody else. So, according to that argument, that's absolutely fine with the evangelicals. And their last point, of course, is sort of a really wishy-washy one. Because they're really grasping at straws because they don't have any real arguments. And the last one, of course, is that if we allow the gays to get married, the sky will fall down. You know, that there'll be some sort of nebulous thing will happen to society where people will start murdering each other in the queue for Tesco's. You know, that's what they're trying to paint this picture, that it's some sort of radical experiment. You know, marriage has been the same forever, they say. It has never changed the definition of marriage, which of course is silly and rubbish and demonstrably untrue. Over the centuries, the definition of marriage has changed many, many, many times. And even today around the world, you know, depending which country in it has a site, it has a different meaning. But they go on as if it's some sort of radical experiment, when, of course, we can all look at the results of that experiment in other countries. You know, Sweden and some of the other countries have had same-sex marriage for quite a number of years now. And I think if you go there, you'll find that children are still eating ice cream. You know, people are still going out to brunch. You know, society continues on. And the only difference is that, you know, a portion of their population, the LGBTI portion, feel more comfortable, feel more respected, feel happier. The sky didn't fall down. So then, to look at Northern Ireland, well, you're in a weird position now, aren't you? You're in this weird position where you're the last part of the UK to bring in same-sex marriage, and down in Dublin, they're having a referendum in the spring, and I am, obviously, I'm not an all-seeing eye, but I'm pretty close, and I'm very positive and hopeful that that is going to pass. And then you'll be in a weird position, won't you? You'll be the only part of these two islands that doesn't allow same-sex couples to get married. So, first of all, morto for you. But and And of course, I don't need to tell you the complex reasons for why that might have ended up that way. But what I will say is a positive thing. It won't last for long. Because, you know, the tide of history is with the LGBTI community. The tide of history is with same-sex marriage. You can see it sort of sweeping across the globe. And it you know, has already, you know, reached close to our shores. So it is coming. And of course, the other thing is, of course, that once it's up and running all around Northern Ireland and people are working with people who've gotten married, you know, in London, you're working with lesbians who got married in Dundalk or wherever it is. God, imagine getting married in Dundalk. No, I didn't mean to pick on you, but but you know, when that happens, all that opposition will slowly melt away because people are practical people, and people will see that, you know, the sky hasn't fallen down in other places, and it is familiarity. Familiarity is the weapon that actually does destroy homophobia. When people know gay people, when they live next door to lesbians, when they've, you know, met a bisexual on the bus, that, and they didn't murder them, you know. That sort of familiarity is what erodes homophobia. And so I would say to you, all of you individually, now I don't have to tell you all to come out, I'm sure you're all flaming, I can see that. But that is still the best, most powerful individual act that anybody can do to achieve a total equality for gay people is to come out. And if you are already out, it's your responsibility to stop checking yourself. To be always openly and proudly gay. Because it's easy to sort of hang on to your homophobia if you think you don't know that many gays. We need to challenge it whenever we see it, big and small. Of course, everyone agrees with us to challenge, you know, the horrible sort of extreme sort of homophobia we see in some countries regularly and even in our own on occasion. Everyone agrees. You know, even the evangelical guy this morning, you know, will say to me, oh, of course, I don't think people should be getting beaten up in the street or lynched. But he's sort of assuming that the kind of rhetoric that they involve themselves in, they assume that that sort of rhetoric exists in a vacuum. He thinks that he can go around demanding that gay and lesbian people be treated differently than everybody else and that that sort of rhetoric has no effect. That the children he's speaking to regularly, that they don't sort of pick up on that sort of difference that he's imposing on us. And of course, that sort of thing does have an effect. It creates an atmosphere in which homophobia is considered normal or acceptable. So, come out bigger. I will say finally that you know, whenever I get into the little scrapes that I get into or say stuff that people, you know, are fed up hearing, especially down in Dublin where they hear from me a lot, and they say often, you know, oh God, I wish that that bloody queen would just shut up. And I agree with them. I'm tired of my own bloody voice sometimes. And I would love to be able to shut up. And of course, there's a very easy way for us both to achieve what we want, and that is to simply allow gay people the exact same respect and privileges that everybody else takes for granted. I'll shut up when that happens, and we can all just move on with our lives. Because you all seem like really lovely people, even the ones from Dundalk. You all seem like lovely people. This is a beautiful venue. Everyone's been very nice to me today. But the truth is, at the risk of offending you all, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be standing here talking about the same subjects, giving out, whinging, whining. I don't want to be doing that. I want to be at home, you know, with my adorable Venezuelan fella and his crinkly eyes, trying to persuade him to make dinner in his underpants. That's where I want to be right now. But I don't feel that I can be there yet because I don't feel respected in the same way and I'm fed up of checking myself. I have never... Are there any straight people here? A few, welcome. They've huddled together for protection. I'm hoping you're a little gayer now. You know, when I look at you, there is one thing that I do envy about you. Just the one. And that thing is, I have never, in my 45 years, casually held hands with a boyfriend the way that I'm sure that you hold hands with your partner. Never in my whole life. I don't know what that feels like. Because even, I mean, obviously, I don't, you know, I won't hold hands with my boyfriend walking down O'Connell Street at 3 a.m. Or if I do, I'm very aware of who's around and who might see me. Because I'm doing that for my own safety. But even if I am walking through bloody Selfridges or Brown Thomas, you know, or Topshop, the gayest place in the world, even there, I have never done that just in the entirely unconscious, casual way that heterosexual couples do. Because even there, if I'm doing it in a place where I feel entirely safe, where I know I'm not going to get a bottle in the face, even there, it's turned into a political act. I'm aware of what I'm doing because other people become aware of it. Now, most of those people are thinking, oh, isn't that lovely? But they're still noticing it. And I don't want them to notice it. Holding hands with their partner in public is a private act in a public place. And there's something special about that. And I have never in my life had that small, tiny thing, one of the small, tiny things that I think makes us human. That small, tiny thing has been denied to me simply because I'm homosexual. And I'm fed up with that. I'm 45, and I'm fed up with it. Anyway, I didn't mean to end on a bum note. Everyone has been absolutely lovely to me, so thank you all so much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Save me, William, save me. Yes, I'll take this.
Candy Bliss!
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you.
Bring something.
Thank you.
Wow.